Welcome to The Burial Plot, horror podcast with Brenda Tolian and Joy Yaley.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to The Burial Plot. I'm here with my co-host, Brenda Tolian, and we're here to bring you the best the horror genre has to offer and those who create it. Brenda, how are things treating you down there in NOLA?
Pretty good. Just going about my business, writing the books. I do have big, exciting news, but I'm sorry, I can't share it yet.
Why would you do this released to us?
Yeah, writing. Okay, well, otherwise it's sunny. It's heading to the 70s. It's Mardi Gras season. I'm loving it. I'm loving it so much.
I'm not going to lie. I'm a little jealous. More than a little jealous. I'm jealous. Yeah, I am. I love NOLA. NOLA is a great place. Love it. Love it there. Do you miss the snow?
Not even a little bit.
The older I get, the less.
We've had fog, like the rolling fog off of the Mississippi. And that just makes the town extra, you know, feeling like, you know, it's definitely Anne Rice's hometown, you know. But if you want the feeling, you can always watch those Interview with the Vampire and the Mayfair Witches on AMC.
Been watching. Yes.
Yeah, because that is definitely got the vibe. It's definitely got the vibe.
I love it. I'm going to have to try to make a plan to come visit soon.
I have a spare bedroom, lady. Come visit.
You're on my way. Well, today, listeners, we have an author who's going to hit you where you live. Author Jeff Wood lives in Colorado Springs, where he spends way too much time staring at the night sky and a little too much time watching baseball. His stories have appeared in over 30 publications such as Boston Phoenix, New York Press, Wild Muset, Fiction at Work, Bright Desire, The Grey Rock Review, Bellowing Arc, and Java Journal. He has a children's play included in the anthology Child's Play in the company of such authors as Sam Shepard and Maya Angelou. Not too shabby of company you keep there, Jeff. Welcome to The Burial Plot.
Well, I appreciate being here. Thanks for inviting me.
Jeff, I said that you were going to hit us where we live because many of your stories are in a particular subgenre of horror that I absolutely adore. I love reading your stuff because it hits me definitely where I live. And that would be the subgenre of suburban horror. And I was wondering if you could help our listeners understand what is that subgenre and how does that look like in your writing?
Well, I'd be happy to. As an aside, I got arrested during a Mardi Gras in New Orleans, maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
How did you do that?
That's a whole other story. It involved throwing beads during Mardi Gras.
Oh my God. You got arrested for throwing beads?
Did you throw them
at the cops?
And my friend got arrested for asking what police department I was going to so he could bail me out. We both got arrested in a matter of like 5 minutes.
Oh, wow. Well, our cops are probably pretty tired and cranky during the Mardi Gras.
Oh, I'm sure they were.
Maybe.
Although at the time, this was like the early 90s, late 80s.
Oh wow!
And the cops there were just insane. Not to hijack your podcast or anything. They had these like portable jails, like these little like buses.
Oh my God!
A few blocks, and they would drive people. They'd fill them up with like, scared white kids like me, you know, and like drive them all off to the thing. And it's just nuts. And to finish that story, we heard a guy get beat up, like pulled off the bus and just beat up. It was really shocking. Like later I can tell the story and laugh, but at the time I was like near tears listening to this guy get beat up. It was just,
I don't doubt it. The politics here and the stuff that happens underneath the surface is epic. and not epic in the best way. And like right now, our murder rate and carjackings and stuff is off the charts. And you got to wonder, well, actually, people are trying to recall the mayor. I don't really have an opinion yet because I'm pretty new here, but just because our crime rate has skyrocketed, you know, the people, I won't say people don't feel safe. I think it, unfortunately, it's accepted, you know, but I still walk around at night, but I also live in a safer part of town. So, you know, it's different for other people that live in other sections of the town because we have hardly any police. So, you know, our police force per capita for the amount of population we have is laughable, actually. So, you know, they can't retain police officers here. But I totally believe you. Yeah. Because, yeah, there's a lot of, yeah, some political ew that happens under the surface in a lot of respects here. So.
Well, not to hijack your podcast. I'll go back to the original question.
No,
I have a scar, though. I have a scar.
Oh, wow. Oh,
my getting my God. Head like slammed into a bus. I could take over your whole podcast and just. Talk about getting arrested in New Orleans for an hour.
Wow.
We're going to have a special Mardi Gras edition, and we're going to have you back, Jeff, and you're going to tell us your story.
I'd be happy to. Anyway, suburban horror. And I don't know where I get, like, it's, well, so I've never lived in suburbia until like the last 5 years or so. I grew up in Iowa. I lived in like funky neighborhoods in Pueblo for quite a while. And we moved to Security Widefield, like just southeast of Colorado Springs, frankly, because my life had just been crazy and I just wanted like peace and quiet and calm and predictability. And the suburbs seems like perfect for that. It just turns out none of those things are actually existent in the suburbs. It's just a different a veil over them. All this crap was happening. So I moved to Security Widefield. I was taking care of my dad and my two daughters. And then one of the daughters left the nest at 18. Second daughter was about to leave the nest. My dad died like at the beginning of 2020, like right when COVID was hitting. And I started taking these long walks, like epic, like in my mind, like mythic walks around this neighborhood, because again, like it was pretty new to me. Just looking at suburbia, and at the time it was, you know, it was 2020. So it was like right before the election, it was during the, you know, summer when I'm able to walk. And so these Trump flags were everywhere. And then like next to the Trump flag, you'd have like a little car with like an NPR sticker there on the bumper, all the kids stuff in the yard. Like it seemed like this thing about conformity was just a lie everybody was telling each other to pretend that it was conformist, but it wasn't. You could like see people's lives, like how they parked their car, what was inside their car, what crap was on their lawn, did they care of their lawn? Like it just seemed like this wonderland of just of self-expression, but nobody was aware they were expressing themselves, if that makes any sense. So I was really, really just kind of turned on by suburbia, and still am. Like I still take the walks, and it still is really kind of a wonderland to me. And so anyway, one of those first walks, I was, because it's like, you know, it's late at night, it's after work. I was still working for CSU. And so the shadows are kind of leaning. And so I turned a corner. You'd always turn a corner when you're facing what? East. And then your shadow would go right out in front of you. And then I turned a corner one day and I saw a second shadow for a while. And that became the first story of these suburban horror stories, which is Trick of the Light. And it was stuff like that. That story was about passing a house and seeing a second shadow when you walk by. I don't know if you guys know the app Nextdoor, which is just like this dumpster fire of just people screaming and complaining about their neighborhood. So I wrote a story about that called goodneighbor.com. We had coyotes in our backyard. Actually, Joy, you're a part of this story that we had coyotes and they were kind of cool. I woke up one morning and I said to my wife, there's a dead dog in our backyard. And I called the city, said, what do you do with this giant dead dog? And then I looked in the backyard. It was like standing there and I realized it was a freaking coyote. And so anyway, I was going to let the coyotes be all like, you know, play and like live in our yard and stuff. And I saw one literally like rip apart a squirrel during like a critique group. Like you were talking, I think. I just watched this coyote rip apart a squirrel and realized I didn't want like coyotes in my yard anymore. So that story became Edge of the Forest. So it's just these pockets of suburbia that just inspire stories. I would say that because I've written a bunch of them, I've written probably 30 of them. And the ones that work, I think the elements are generally an idea of like menace hiding in everyday objects, menace hiding in the familiar is kind of the key to these stories. Also, maybe the idea that there are larger things going on that you don't quite have a grasp of. That there's something going on that you're just seeing glimpses of, but that's all you're getting is glimpses. And I guess in those two things, the menace hiding in the familiar and this sense that there are larger plans afoot, maybe with a couple, the two big, like, I don't know, anchors for suburban poor. It's a really long answer.
No, perfect answer. And that describes why I love it so much. Because I live in a similar area as you do. I'm not a suburb of a large city. I'm actually part of a small town, but where I live in a master developed neighborhood. So it's kind of similar with all the different walking paths and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the cookie cutter kind of homes, there's like seven different floor plans and everything like that. But yeah, it's all so different, and everybody who lives here is so different. But it's
because there's an infinite amount of variety in those seven floor plans, like it's just
right.
There's a real beauty to that.
During Halloween, I like when my kids were little, I'd like to go and try to peek in people's houses and see how did they have their little room in the front decorated, because I am decorated challenged. So I would peek and say, oh, that's how you do that. That's what that thing's for. Oh, okay. Gotcha. So yeah, but I mean, just the variety in that is also interesting. Right. And the way that my house sits, we back up to an open space and there's a hiking trail through there. And then across the gully, there's other houses across from me. So it's kind of like rear window. If people keep their blinds up at night and I look out my back kitchen window, I can see into my neighbor's houses pretty clearly. And one night I had all the lights off and I was staying there. And my husband's like, what the heck are you doing? Are you spying on the neighbors? I'm like, well, I'm trying to get some story ideas. So yeah, no, I get it. I love it. And goodneighbor.com. That's not the one with the coyote and the squirrel, but that's the kind of the app, the neighborhood app thing. That one is like one of my all-time favorites. I talk about it to friends when they're complaining about their neighbors on Nextdoor. I'm like, oh, you got to read this thing my friend Jeff wrote. Because that one is so good. Because it's so true about how apathetic we are about what's really happening outside our windows and how gossipy those sites are. They're awful, actually. They're terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Nextdoor got the worst of everything. It just really... people are mean on there. And what your thing reminded me, that I always get scared that, because I walk nearly every day and I'm just wandering around looking in cars and crap. I'm sure I have been mentioned, like there's this strange guy wearing a t-shirt I don't understand.
I'm sure.
Yes, the same way. Just a writer's instincts are going to make you suspect.
100%. I think of your story. Because I don't have that app, but I do think of your story because they have like on Facebook groups for the various wards in New Orleans. And so I follow the ward that I live in and stuff. So yeah, so you could be walking around thinking everything's fine. But then if you open up the app and you're like, you know, everybody's watching, I don't know, naked guy on, you know, St. Charles or something like that, you know, and stuff. And, you know, there was a couple of rapes that happened on St. Charles on our side of town in the middle of day, like at noon.
Oh my gosh.
Like, how could that even happen? Because it's St. Charles. Like, people are out walking around. Like, how does that even happen there? You know? And stuff. And I'm just like, you know, the strange. And then, of course, you know, everybody's talking about it, you know, or like we've had a couple of carjackings in this part of town and how everybody's talking about it. And I'm just like, oh, this is like, you know, it's almost like a, yeah, unfortunately, or, you know, story ideas, but I was reminded by, I maybe it was the surveillance aspect, because everybody's got a Ring camera, you know. Oh, yeah. And people are sharing these, they're sharing video, they're sharing photos, and you as a citizen just walking around, you don't have any kind of, there's no privacy anymore, you know, at all, anywhere. There just isn't. And so that to me is kind of frightening in a way, you know, just constant surveillance, you know.
It's almost like it's, you know, bifurcated, where like you have the actual reality of walking around on the street, and then you have this secondary next door reality of all the surveillance of you and all the conversations happening around you as you walk. It's like the security reality versus, you know, actual walking on the street reality.
Weird. It's like big brother, like in practice or something almost, right? Like I raise German Shepherds. So I currently have a big pandemic baby who, for female, she's enormous. She's almost 90 pounds for a female German Shepherd. That's quite large. And she's spoiled because she was a pandemic baby. So she's never been alone. She and I have been connected to the hip this, you know, since the pandemic started. Well, when I had my injury, my accident, I would go for walks with my neighbor. And she couldn't come because there's no way I can walk that dog and try to walk. I mean, the wind almost blew me over. That's how pathetic I was in the beginning. And she and I are walking and holding hands. Well, unbeknownst to me, while I'm gone, my German Shepherd is going insane in my house and screaming, because that's what they do. One of my neighbors put on next door, I can't tell what house is coming from, but I hear a woman screaming. I think someone needs to call 911. And it was like several weeks later that I saw this post and I was like, oh my God, well, that's my neighbor. So I go over and I ring her doorbell and I'm like, hey, I think the screaming was my dog. She's like, oh my God, I was going to call 911. Like, yeah, that would have been really embarrassing. But it is interesting that not only like your neighbors are watching what you're doing, but they're broadcasting, which is a horror in and of itself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, then I have teenagers too, so I'm kind of always concerned about when I leave them here by themselves. I'm like, oh, I hope this doesn't end up on Nextdoor or something, you know.
It's interesting because the first, like, I didn't figure that story would be, I'd make it 3 pages, but it just seemed too gimmicky to be a useful story. But the original idea was actually of somebody getting possessed and of like their neighbors going to, like your dog, of just like, what's going on, there's something going on in this house. But yeah, just what a possession would be like if you could only hear about it from the people reacting to it on Nextdoor.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting topic that you should probably, I would go down that trail actually, Jeff, because that's interesting. Now I'm thinking about it and I'm like, there's one house down the street where everybody was convinced there's something nefarious happening here. Something weird is going on in this house, blah, blah, blah. And you know, I try not to be the gossipy neighbor lady. I try not to. And I would just like ignore it, whatever. Well, literally one day I'm walking and I come around the corner and they have it taped off with police crime tape. There's two cop cars. There's a crime scene unit in the driveway. I'm like, what the hell? It was like an illegal grow house. But so, I mean, it wasn't as, I want to say, interesting. I don't know if that's the right word. It wasn't as interesting as I would have hoped it was going to be. But, you know, dead bodies in the basement would have been a lot better for me. Personally, would have sparked more of a story. But no, I love it. And I think the reason that some of the suburban horror is so, like, even though you thought it was gimmicky, but it struck a chord, is because that's so much of our, you know, your regular day-to-day experiences, this kind of suburban stuff. And I think we all suspect there's something going on under the surface of everything, right? And so it's kind of interesting when someone brings that out. I love it. I could even see that like as being, I wanted it to be an anthology. I'm like, let's write an anthology and that's going to be the theme. I might still do that. I don't know, Jeff, you can be my co-editor on that one. I'm still thinking about that because I love that genre so much. And when you're, you know, you said you've wrote about 30 of these types of stories, but you write other types of stories as well. But in your work, do you find that certain themes like reoccur or resurface, or you're delving into the same type of ideas over and over in stories? Do you ever find that in your writing?
Yeah, I mean, it's have you guys ever heard of a playwright named Harold Pinter?
I have not.
Anyway, great writer. I was obsessed with him when I majored in theater. Just a useless major. As a result, I read a lot of playwrights, and he really kind of pounded in the idea of the scene that I remember. Like, I actually remember this like idea settling in my brain is that of a phone ringing and everybody in the room having conversation and just stopping and looking at the phone. And in the theatrical space, that phone just suddenly takes on like all this gravity and all this power. And that idea has stuck with me for decades now. And I think, and really comes through now in suburbia and in the idea that there is menace or potential menace that lurks in the everyday. So I think if there's a running theme, it's that things are not always as they seem. You're not looking deep enough, or they're looking like other things. One of the early, this was before I moved to, way before I moved to pretty wide field, but one of the first successful stories dealing with this was about, this is so weird, the sentient grocery carts, like from the grocery store, and how they would form, because you're an alien, like in an urban environment, you want to hide yourself as something familiar that nobody's going to fuck with and people will assume like is just supposed to be there. And grocery carts are everywhere. So if you were like an invading alien or a shapeshifter or something from underneath the earth, which is what they actually are, that that the way a way to hide would be as a grocery cart, because they're everywhere, because nobody, you know, gives them a second look. And they develop these like symbiotic relationships with homeless men and hopeless people. So to kind of push them around and take care of them as they take care of the homeless men, because they can attack, you know, because they're, so I guess that's a good early example of trying to see past the familiar, I guess, trying to imagine what's past the familiar shapes.
Yeah,
I don't know if that answered your question or not.
No, that does. And I love it. Now I'm never going to look at grocery carts the same way ever again. No.
You really don't. Like,
I'll be sure to say, excuse me and thank you from now on.
Or like when one's like tipped over on its side, like it died, or one's at a bus stop. Like it's, yeah, once that idea like enters your head, like this whole mythology kind of enters with it. It's a neat idea.
It is a neat idea. I love that. Huh. Now you've got some wheels turning over here, which is always a scary proposition. So one of your stories, and correct me if I'm wrong, but A Trick of the Light, that was not the one that had to do with coyotes. That was the double shadow type idea. Is that right?
Yeah, Trick of the Light was the double shadow. That was No okay. Sleep.
And that one got dramatized on No Sleep podcast, which I love listening to that podcast. What was that experience like as an author to hear your story come to life in that way?
It was cool. They're a really good group of people. They don't answer their emails. So if you ever get a story published, they'll never talk to you. I was surprised at how high the production values were. Like there was music in the background. There were sound effects. It was just really well done. And I think the most interesting thing was that the guy, because there wasn't a lot of dialogue, it was mostly just, you know, one guy talking, like a first person monologue almost, was that he was making different choices than I was making. Because I always you read it in your head when you're writing it and you're emphasizing different words. And it was just interesting to hear like another person come into that story and look at those sentences and emphasize different parts of the sentences than I was when I was writing it. So that was kind of, it was like seeing it with fresh eyes, I suppose. It was neat.
And how did you, like, did you just, you are you listener to that podcast, and that's how you knew how to, that's what interested you in submitting, or
you, how did you? You cut out at the very first part of that. Can you say that again?
I'm sorry. Yeah. How did you come across them and want to do a submission to them? Was it just like, are you listener to that podcast, or did you hear about it somewhere else?
Some. I'm really bad at like sending out short stories and like getting published. I see you roll your eyes. We all are. It's just so, it's so hard. Like, you know, you have to have certain stuff in the subject line and yada yada yada. It's just, it's, there's a lot of crap I'm not very good at involving being really detail oriented, which I'm not. So I think I just came upon them. I had heard of them, obviously, because they're a pretty big deal. And I had listened to a few, but it was mostly just, you know, going through Duotrope, finding places that might take a story. I actually didn't think that would sell because it didn't have a lot of dialogue, though it did have a lot of sound effects. And it was also towards the edge. It's almost too long for them. So I actually didn't think they were going to buy it. I was really surprised and really happy because they did a really good job with it.
Yeah, it was good. I thought they did a great job with it. I really did. It was very entertaining. I like listening to their, I've never submitted to them just because I don't ever think I have anything that would translate well.
Mm-hmm. Into that meeting. You should try, because I didn't think this would translate at all, because it's all prose. There's no dialogue. It didn't seem like it would be a good fit, but it ended up, I think maybe first person stories are a really good fit for them because it's like a monologue, you know.
Sure. Yeah. So you said that you studied theater. So yeah. Are you involved in the theater still? Have you written plays other than your child's play? Or
no, that's weirdly, you would think that I would be writing plays, but I'd like to think I'm really good at dialogue because of theater, but I really haven't made the jump. There's a group in town called the Funky Theater Company that do 10-minute plays, and I think they're location-based, like a bus stop or a car or something like that. And that was, I think that's about 10 months away. So I'm trying to think of a 10-minute play, and I'm trying to think of what a horror play would look like, because that's a rare thing too. There's not a lot of horror in plays. So I'm playing with that idea, but I don't know. I don't have anything yet.
There needs to be more horror plays. I agree.
It would be, it's such a cool 100%, idea.
100%.
There's a bunch of cool theater that came out during the pandemic because they couldn't do like productions and stuff. And so it's called the Candle House Collective. I think they're out of San Francisco, but they do theater by phone, where because you can't have, you know, couldn't have audiences at the time. So you'd pay like $25 for a ticket, and they would say, okay, we're going to call you around 6:30. Here's your safe word. They like gave you a safe word in case you got scared or like freaked out or something. And they just call you. And it's kind of semi-scripted, but there's clearly like a shape to it. They have a talented actor who can work with like improv at the other end. So that's the kind of thing that I'm looking at. I think that horror theater has got, there's a lot of ways you can go with that. And I think during the pandemic, theater got really interesting. Like I thought, it really exploded into a bunch of different ways to throw out a script to an audience. So that's what I'm looking at. The idea of a telephone play is really interesting to me. And the idea of like a 10-minute like location-based play is really interesting too. So I don't know what'll come of it, but those are my ideas right now.
Yeah, that's super creepy over the phone. I love it. You could do a Zoom thing so they could have like a party or something. I don't know.
There's a Zoom horror movie. Have you guys seen this? It's really good. Sucked up. What's it called again?
Oh. I forget what it's called.
I don't remember either. It was really good though.
Yeah, it starts off like any other, you know, like Zoom. there was actually a couple of those. And a lot of high schools, even not necessarily horror, but they were moving their high school productions onto Zoom. You know, people were getting really creative with what we had. I don't remember what that movie. That movie was good though.
There was a play called The Wolves about a girls' soccer team that got done in town a couple, like maybe a year ago. Really good production.
It's called Host.
Host. Yeah, it's a good movie. So yeah, it's pandemic Zoom horror is my, if that's your thing, then check out The Host or Host. But this play, The Wolves, was done, I think it was a Broadway play, the pandemic hit, and they did it as a Zoom, and it apparently was a really successful Zoom play, you know, out of Broadway, of all places.
It's just a new medium, I guess, to use, right? For entertainment, Zoom. Although there was a period of time when I was so tired of Zoom, I couldn't hardly see straight. But that was because my kids were using it for school, and I think we were all kind of insane at that moment in time. So,
it was an insane.
I like it now because there's a lot of things that I can participate in that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise, because I, you know, wasn't able to travel or whatever. But yeah, that's interesting. I'm happy to see where that's going. I would like to see more horror theater. Actually,
I know it's kind of surprising that it's not a genre that's done in horror or in theater, because you could pull it off. Like, there's lots of scary stuff.
I saw Colorado Ballet's production of Dracula, and that was excellent, absolutely excellent, creepy. Beautifully done, the music, the lighting, the sets, it was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And I took my husband one time to see Young Frankenstein at the Colorado Center for Performing Arts, and that was done very well too. But it had some scary moments, like they made part of it kind of scary, and it was good. So yeah, I would love to see more of that. I would absolutely love it.
Did they do Aladdin?
I'm sorry?
Did they do the lab with the...
Yeah. All the electricity and all the stuff, and they had the switching hump and everything, and
so cool.
The violins and Frau Brucker and the horse neighing offside, and it was done really well. It was very funny. We had a good time at that. So, and I don't know if you guys, well, Brenda may not, because she hadn't really lived down in this part of Colorado, but do you remember the at Heritage Square, Jeff, maybe you don't know either, but Heritage Square used to have a theater, Heritage Square out in Golden. And it was like a comedy dinner theater kind of thing. And one time they did The Hounds of the Baskervilles, and it was a comedy, but it wasn't. Like, part of it was kind of scary. You know, you're in this old creepy theater kind of basement thing, and it's dark, and they would have like wolves howling in the back, and I was just always thought, yeah, this would be kind of cool at Halloween time, right? So let's do it, Jeff.
not to belabor the thing about theater, but I saw a Sam Shepard play once, and the guy, like, it's too bad that that you can't see me as well during a podcast, but the guy at the center of stage during like the climax of the play opened his mouth, and he had a plastic spider on his tongue, and he just opened his mouth and like stuck his tongue out, and the audience saw that spider there and like gasped. It was scary as F. Excuse me.
Oh yeah.
I'll probably steal that for my own horror, but it was just an incredible moment.
Yeah. Everybody that knows me knows I don't do spiders, so I probably would have freaked out.
Well, it was really freaky. You did not expect it at all. It was just boom. Suddenly there was a spider on a tongue. And like intellectually, you could say, okay, just stuck a plastic spider in his mouth. It was still such an arresting image and so unexpected. It was just like wonderful stagecraft.
Nice.
Again, I'll probably steal that moment, but it was really powerful.
The National Theater put out Frankenstein too, and made it available during COVID, and it had who was in it? It was Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict. I always say his last name wrong. Cumberbatch, whatever. My kids make fun of me because I can't say his last name. And that has some pretty freaky moments too, just because it's going, like, you watch movies of it. That's one interpretation. You have the book, which is a totally another interpretation, but this play, you know, it's done on a very, it's a pretty small stage, you know, in comparison to other stages. And it also is circular, so it's revolving and stuff. And the way that they were able to show the horrific scenes, you know, of the play in such a small area, you know, was really interesting. Plus the both of the cast, you know, for Frankenstein and the creature, both those actors, it was like every other night or every couple of nights they would switch who played the role.
Frankenstein and Frankenstein's creature?
Yeah, so they would
switch. Oh, that's so cool.
They would switch off. And so you were getting, just with the switch of actors, you were getting two different interpretations too, just by that physical switch of actors and how, what they brought to that particular role and stuff. So, you know, it makes you wonder if, because horror is kind of seeing this popularity surge, not that it hasn't been, you know, popular, but I would say it's almost in some respects having more respect built into it as an art form, whether it's, you know, writing, you know, on the film screen or what, like there's a little bit more, people are taking it a little bit more seriously as communicating these themes and ideas and stuff, that that even revisiting older texts, you know, like Frankenstein and Dracula, like they have a new interpretation, you know, coming about. I mean, if you just look at vampires, starting with, well, even before Dracula was published, there was other works before that, and then watching the progression of how vampires change over time, you know, which actually kind of figures into your idea on observing as you do suburban culture, you know, like what's going on, because suburbia has changed. You know, originally it was supposed to be these boroughs that were just outside the city where people could afford a home, da da. That's not always true, you know. I mean, when I lived in Sugar Grove outside of Chicago, you know, those houses were $400,000 or more, you know. Mm-hmm. And which is funny because the windows in those things just let that, you know, Illinois Chicago breeze right through. But but that like idea of the originally who was in the suburbs and then, you know, who exists in the suburbs now, you know.
Yeah, well, there's a, because the I think that when people hear suburbia now, they think of Levittown, they think of like all the, you know, the houses that look alike. But this was like Security Whitefield, where I was living, and kind of where I am now, though it's a little nicer neighborhood. So it's suburbia, but it's their starter homes, and they're people kind of like barely subsisting. And a lot of them, I think, are army folks. And so, and this was during COVID. So there was also really a sense of isolation of people kind of like being just shut up in their homes and having those, you know, it was almost like those cars in the front yard were like a bit of a, like a gate or a barricade or a fence or something. It was really a strange time to be in a suburb and in a you know, a suburb of starter homes where there wasn't a lot of money. So there were no like boats around, or there was not, you know, none of the fancier suburbs. It was just kind of people hunkering down in these small homes. I tried to live through this, you know, freaking all this stuff, not just COVID, but this upcoming election where people were saying that they're, you know, we're going to send armies of poll watchers. Everything was feeling very, you know, politicized. And it was just a really interesting time to live in a suburb, because it wasn't that standard Levittown, everybody's fine thing. It was kind of this hunkered down behind our barricades sort of thing.
Do you ever, have you ever looked at writing about like the homeowners association in particular? Just like those mystical, you never see them until you painted your house the wrong color or you planted the wrong plant in the front. Your shrubbery is above so many inches or something like that. Have you ever covered or anything like that?
The goodneighbor.com has an HWA guy in it, but he's more annoying than any greater mystery. I have it. That's a good idea. And I'm always, you know, look like I spent a year because I retired. I think I mentioned that earlier in these talking about walking, is that I got to retire early from CSU. And where am I going with this?
Homeowner.
Oh, yeah. And there was very little because it was a poor neighborhood, a poor-ish neighborhood, these starter homes. So the homeowner association there was really chill. They were very kind of standoffish. But I'm in a different neighborhood now where they're a little more where they're a little more scary. So I might what I was going with before is that when I first retired, I spent about a year just writing stories. They were all about suburbia. And now I'm because I've been writing short stories for a long time. I'm trying to learn how to write novels now. So between novels, I'm writing little packets of like suburbia stories and then jumping off to the next novel. So I'll keep the HWA thing in mind. That's a good idea.
There's a episode on the X-Files. I'm dating myself now, but I don't even know the name of the episode or whatever, but they're undercover as the Mulder and Scully are undercover as a married couple, and they're in suburbia and their light goes out on their front lawn. They have a light post in the front lawn and the light goes out and all the neighbors are like, oh my God, and they're like, oh, okay, kind of freaking out. And it turns out like there's some kind of creature that comes and eats you if you fuck up the rules or whatever. So that you might start with that episode. I don't know the name of it. I'm sorry. I can't even remember, but it was a good one because at that time we were just thinking of moving to a place that had an HOA and my husband was dead set against it. And he's like, see what happens when you move to those places. And now here we are in those places.
It's Arcadia season 6, episode 15.
There you go. You got to watch it, Jeff, and you'll get some ideas. But yeah, that would be an interesting thing to think about. Yeah. No, our HOAs can be real, real jerks. They were just a funny story. Last summer, they were on everybody's case for having brown lawns because, you know, we have watering restrictions in Colorado. And so to save whatever, they decided not to water the lawn in the common areas. So whenever they would send somebody a picture of your dead lawn, that people would go out and take a picture of their dead lawn and send it back to them. And then my HOA sued itself, which was great. Really? That was awesome. Yep. Yep. They sued themselves. I was like, okay, great. Awesome.
That's sort of one of the ideas in how do we keep going back to Denver.com, but what do you do if something like appears before an HOA, like blood smeared across the dumpster, like it's evidence of something that they can't control and they don't understand. But that's, you know, I'm sure that kind of, you know, dead birds, a whole bunch of dead birds, like lying at the bottom of the dumpster. Where did that come from? So the idea of having this official organization stymied because real life is not making sense and is not going to be codified into their rules is a good idea.
I'm just going to give you a little bit of research help. So look into the Crestone POA.
Crestone? Like the mountain town?
Yeah.
POA. What does that even
say? It's I forget what it stands for, but it's their HOA of the Baca, okay. Like outside of town. You will find all of those kinds of things in their notes. Yeah, and their notes are mostly available online, and they read super weird. We'll just say super weird. You'll find craziness. So there you go. A little writer's help from the valley that I like to write about. It has something for everyone. So it has HOAs and you name it. So there you go. Look it up. Just, oh my God. Yeah. The meeting minutes are so bizarre. We'll just say bizarre. It's a bizarre place.
Look forward to it.
It's definitely an interesting place. No place like the Valley, that is for certain. That is for certain. So, Jeff, we're all writers here, and we all have our own writing journey and our own process of how we get things down on paper. What do you find when you're writing? Like, what's the most challenging part of writing for you? Is it starting a story? Is it editing a story? What's the most challenging part?
Well, the most annoying part is marketing. Sending the stories out, all that stuff. I'm not good at that. And I don't think about it enough, I don't think. But what works, and this is very specific to my like writing journey, as you put it, is that when I stopped working, when I took early retirement, I told myself, okay, you're going to write 1,000 words a day. And suddenly I was like, oh my God, I have to write 1,000 words a day. And that oddly has been the best part, that I have been able to get up and just write. And it's not always good. Like sometimes it's just crappy 1,000 words. But I think the most gratifying thing has just, there's something really, really gratifying about waking up in the morning and going, what am I writing today? And not about like, you know, oh, I'm going to write about Pueblo, but just, you know, I'm going to write these 3 pages today about this thing. And just waking up in the morning, being in bed and just planning my day around, this is what I'm writing today, is really, really satisfying. I mean, and fairly new to me still. I guess I'm a little over 2 years into it now. I just love that feeling. And I've never really had that feeling before. I've always been like, at jobs and family and, you know, obligations. And I still have some obligations. And I still have 50 phone calls from my daughters every day, but I generally get it right. I get it right every day. And that's a new thing. And it's a really fulfilling thing. And I'm what's surprising is that I'm able to do it, that I actually can slam out 1,000 words every day that tend to be good. They're not always good, but it's a good enough success rate. So it's gratifying.
Well, I've found everything that I've read of yours to be extremely, extremely engaging or entertaining. Can you guys hear me? Is there a problem?
No, I can. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying that everything that I've read of yours, Jeff, that I've read is engaging and entertaining. And so whatever word you're churning out, you're doing a good job there. So I appreciate you as a writer. Absolutely. I'm a huge fan, big fan.
I was telling my wife, because of the 2 critique groups, you have read a lot of my writing. Like you've probably read half my output recently.
Yeah. It's really, I'm a huge fan. I love it. You've got great ideas and you communicate them well, and you communicate it in a way that is entertaining, engaging, and really does kind of talk to people where they're at. You know, I think that's what makes your stories fun for me, and I love it. I could see like some of your stuff showing up on, you know, like what they used to do, the Tales from the Dark Side series. I don't know if there's one equivocal to it now, but I could definitely see some of those being, you know, one of those episodes, because it's so like weird and creepy, and everybody be like could relate to it. Everyone would be like, yeah, I get that.
What I think I'm good at, and so when I'm playing to my strengths, I write towards this, is I think I'm good at capturing the emotional, a small emotional moment inside like a much larger like craziness moment. So that's
kind of
what I write towards. A lot of my monsters are off screen or like just show up briefly, and it's just really about conversations and folks talking in a room. Regardless of the monster outside the room, a lot of stories end up just being about those two folks in the room talking.
That doesn't surprise me, because from what I've read, there's a element of humanity, you know, realness in the characters that makes you care about them. But that's also what I find in your character as well. Which, you know, it's one thing to read a story that has that element in it, but we often, sometimes that doesn't connect to the author. Mm-hmm. And so I think the reality of the kind of human you are comes out also in your writing. And it has that very empathetic sensitivity to it that I think does make it easy to connect to. Wouldn't you say that too, Joy?
Yeah, I agree completely. That's exactly what I was trying to say. But of course, you know, Brenda's the smart one in this duo. So
anyway, that's very gratifying to hear.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to your novels, Jeff. Really looking forward to them.
Write a good one first.
So, Jeff, obviously, we like to hear, we're greedy and we like to hear people's stories and readings and whatever. So have you prepared something to share with us for this podcast?
I have. And this might be a story you're getting sick of, Joy.
No,
you'll read this on read the whole thing at Critique Group. And I got to read this, even though it's not, I'm still having issues with it. And that's why it's going into Critique Group. It's a weird, it's horror and sci-fi and like American realism. Like the first paragraph is like Hemingway with giant monsters is what I was going for anyway. So Hemingway with monsters is the set of the first paragraph. And I guess as a preface, I'll say it's about raising daughters in a time of monsters. This is called Dandelions. I'll just read the first third or so. It goes between the point of view of the daughter and the father. So this is the father's first point of view section. This is called Dandelions. They could hear the Anakim for tens of miles in every direction. The sound carried far in the wide Nebraska skies, across barren fields, crushed forest, ruined cities. Clouds of dust and soil rode up on the air and hovered high in the skies, towering like cumulus as the great beasts crossed the plains. Tara told her dad once they sounded like giant tires on gravel. He always associated tires on gravel with comfort, with coming home, but maybe the meaning had changed. Rock and earth crushed by overwhelming weight. You could feel the sound of it in your bones. "This coffee tastes like shit," she said to her dad. "It's chicory," Joe replied after a pause. "I know it's chicory." Silence. She said shit in an attempt to bait him, knowing he didn't like her to swear. "Don't react," he told himself. She said once he was being hypocritical, not allowing her to swear, even though he did it frequently. He was a child, he told her, a minor. The rules were different for her. He tried to lighten the moment. "I know you know it's chicory," he said. Nothing. Like talking to a wall. He continued babbling about nothing, really. "They grow it west of here, out in Ogallala. Some farm started growing it after the coffee ran out. The roots for coffee, but the leaves too. They use it for the feed, for, you know, cows and pigs. Probably still do." He didn't think she was listening, so he quit talking. She said, "So this is pig food?" He nodded his head to the uneaten link of sausage on her plate. "Yep, actual pig too, pork sausage." "It's disgusting." "I'm sorry you feel that way." Hoping for a reaction, he reached out with his fork and stabbed the meat off her plate and popped it into his mouth. He got an eye roll. That counted as a reaction, right? "It's good sausage made just up the road. See, not everything went to hell when the bone dogs came. We're eating better." "Nobody calls them bone dogs, Dad. You got that from that dumb show on the radio." "Maybe. Most people called them the Anakim, something from the Bible, a race of giants or something. Joe didn't know from the Bible, but he did listen to the radio. It was the only voice he heard for hours on end. Tara stayed in the back seat mostly and slept. She was looking better, he thought, more color in her face. Her mouth seemed more relaxed. She seemed less sick than when he'd first picked her up. For 2 days, they'd been driving across Nebraska to take her to her mother's house. They hadn't gotten far from Fairbury to Cairo, a little over 120 miles. The going was slow. Most of their driving had been on a sensible grid of gravel farm roads that stretched from horizon to horizon. Entire stretches of highway had been erased by the Anakim. Entire cities, too, according to the radio. And there were roadblocks and men with guns and usurious gas prices. Sometimes he had to improvise. Tyra to Broken Bow was another 60 miles. That would take them all of today and a good chunk of tomorrow, too. Moms, they could figure out what to do next. Kara hadn't tasted wax in 3 weeks. Jo got the blood test from the doctor as they left the clinic. She was deep in withdrawal as she piled her meager belongings in the back seat 3 days ago, but seemed to be doing better today. Her attention lay on a kid who sat at the counter of the restaurant drinking a soda. Probably a local boy looking for something to break the small town monotony, giving his daughter a little exploratory eye contact. He wanted to turn and look at him, perhaps pin him to the wall with a warning glare, but that would result in a sigh from his daughter, pregnant with exasperation. They use dandelions too. Kara shifted her attention from the counter to him again when he spoke. He'd interrupted some kind of look between her and the kid. And the coffee, they use dandelions too, the roots. Brew them right in the coffee along with the chicory root. Makes it taste better. It still tastes like shit. Okay. He didn't jump to her bait. He's right, you know. Dandelions make it taste less bitter. The waitress strolled up to their table and refilled the coffee. She smiled broadly as she poured. They're both weeds, chicory and dandelions. They grow everywhere. Hard to kill. We have fields of them out back behind the kitchen. Go look before you leave. Fields of bright yellow dandelions as far as you can see. The way she said the word made it sound like dandelions. Her pronunciation made him smile and even seemed to break through Kara's barriers. When the waitress left, she allowed her dad a small grin. Bright yellow dandelions, he whispered to his daughter amid hitting the waitress. Kara snickered. His heart lifted at the response. Then her eyes flitted over to the boy at the counter again, and her face clouded over, a sudden storm. Fuck it, he turned to look. The kid turned his head to meet his gaze. He was a teenager, attractive in a generic way. He was also clearly waxed. The set of his mouth gave him away. Wax lips, the kids called it. The way he held his lips in a sort of rictus told the story. It was like how smoking weed back in Joe's youth always advertised its youth with sleepy, droopy eyes. That disturbing, unnatural smile meant he was using wax. He'd seen it in the faces of countless kids in rehab. He'd seen it in his daughter's face. His daughter was trolling for wax. The realization hit him like a rock. She was waiting for him to go to the bathroom or pay the bill or something, and she'd go over to this kid and score. Had she been doing it this entire trip? He watched her with a sidelong glance, searching for any signs of the rictus the drug always caused. He could find no trace. If they paid the bill and got up and left, that would solve the problem. He would take away the temptation of scoring wax from the boy by leaving. A burst of sympathy for his daughter poured from his heart, fresh out of rehab, confronted by a cute boy, obviously under the influence of her drug of choice. He felt nothing but anger at the boy. He motioned for the waitress for the check. She nodded, acknowledging him with a broad smile. You about ready to go, honey? Silence. In the distance, the plumes of debris rose from the flat plains. When he listened closely, he could hear the low clatter and groan of the Anakim off in the fields. The earth shook with their movement, the bite of their chains. Maybe he shouldn't have called her honey. They used to call her honey, bunny, little buddy. Was he no longer allowed these terms of endearment now that she was older? What was he to call his daughter now? Yeah, I'm ready. She'd eaten almost none of her breakfast. It might be a symptom of withdrawal. Fresh sympathy bloomed in his heart. Get her away from this boy and into the car. Another family entered the West restaurant, and the waitress met him at the door and showed them a booth. It would be a few more minutes before she brought them a check. He decided to hit the bathroom. The upcoming drive would be long and slow. He told his daughter he'd be right back. He gave the boy a menacing dad glare as he rode from the booth, as he rose from the booth. The kid responded with that stupid fake grin. Still, a long drive lay ahead of them. He couldn't hold his pee in the entire trip. He had to be able to trust her sometime. He'd be back so quickly nothing bad could happen, he assured himself and scooted out of his side of the booth. And I'll stop it there.
Yeah, no, I'm not sick of that story, Jeff.
Is it going to be a novel?
No. It's the, I won't say too much about it. The Anakim and the monsters are setting. It's about like letting go in your daughters into a world that's just full of freaking monsters. So the monsters are not like the enemy to be defeated, and the plot is not about like killing these monsters. They're the setting. The setting is just these giant biblically sized monsters just scouring the earth. So it's just a story. It's a story about a dad and a daughter just in a time of monsters.
Well, it's kind of like real life, right? Like a metaphor.
Very much like real life.
I know I have four girls that I'm raising. And like I was telling you earlier, my oldest is police officer. And I wish she would get any kind of other job, any other job. I'd be just pleased as punch, but she would hate it, right? So yeah, I mean, it's like talk about releasing your kid into a world of monsters. Here we go, right? Yeah,
we're all here on the screen raising daughters. Like
it's even just what we were talking about earlier off before we started the podcast, just about some experiences that we've had as female writers in different spaces. It's kind of a good metaphor. That's why I'll never get tired of that story, Jeff. So don't ever say that. But it is a good start to a novel. I think Brenda's onto something.
I was just thinking of, you know, works like The Road, you know, The Road by Cormac is, this reminds me of that, just that idea. Yeah, it's like the end of the world and whatnot in that book, but that isn't really what it's about. It's about a father, you know, and the child, you know, making it through this.
Is kind of, you know, it's doing okay. It's just, it's a soft apocalypse, which is what the previous.
Yeah, one. But I could totally sympathize with your characters. You know, it has that sensitivity, but a reality to it that is striking, and it's already tension built. You know, it's already building up that. The parental mama tension in me.
Well, thank you for that. I don't think I've solved it yet because there's a lot of elements, but I'm really close to that story. I really like it.
I like it. Yeah, I'll never get tired of it. That's for sure. Like Brenda was saying, there's some type of, it pricks some type of humanity in you as a parent that sometimes is hard to articulate, even though you're feeling it, but it's hard to put words to it. But I think the way the dad is just like, kind of the way he's feeling in that scene, I think all parents of daughters have felt that one time or another in one degree or another, depending on the situation. So I think it's well done and I'm looking forward to more of it, for sure. So speaking of novels and things like that, Jeff, what are you working on? What is next for you?
Well, I'm writing a novel about Pueblo, so I'm actually kind of veering away from suburbia to write about Pueblo. We talked about this before the broadcast started, that there's some special issues with moving away from suburbia and talking about Pueblo. And it's called either The Black Forge or The Abriendo. I can't really figure out the title yet. And that's it. I'm just working away on that.
Nice. We're looking forward to everything that comes off of that desk. And where can our listeners find out more about your stuff and your work?
Well, I don't have books because I just write short stories. So, I mean, probably a collection someday and perhaps a novel someday. But I write a newsletter now. I guess it was a blog years ago called The Oort Cloud. which is on Substack. So if anybody wants to find my work, I always link off the new stories that are published or when I'm reading on the Oort Cloud on Substack. And I'm really trying to grow that newsletter. So everybody write down the Oort Cloud on Substack.
We'll put links to it in the show notes so everybody can find you easily. Oh, cool. And Jeff also hosts short virtual critique groups, not meaning like short people, but short stories for the Denver Horror Collective. And you can go to the Denver Horror Collective's Facebook page to find out when Jeff is hosting those as well. You don't have to be a part of the collective to join the critique groups. And that might be something that might interest some people that are also short story writers.
I can sneak in. I think every short story we've talked about has gone through that critique group, as long as just a ton of other good stories. So if you want a group of talented short story writers, that's the place.
And many of those stories have gone on to publication that have been workshopped in those critique groups. So look that up as well, everybody. We'll have all of the links in the show notes so it's easy to find. As usual, I'm always on joyyaley.com and Brenda is on brendatolian.com. And Brenda, anything else to add before we sign off? No.
Not really. Good show. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks so much for spending time with us. And we are going to have to think about having a Mardi Gras special program, I think, just to talk about horror stories that happened to Jeff in New Orleans.
For sure. Yes, we do.
We'll keep you abreast of that, Jeff. Until next time, everybody, stay above ground.